From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
An investigation into the misuse of isolated quiet rooms to punish students was published by the Chicago Tribune and ProPublica.
Throughout schools in Illinois, kids who misbehave are being placed in isolated rooms. Decades-old state law requires school employees constantly monitor those children and be able to see inside the rooms. But a recent statewide investigation revealed ongoing misuse of this practice that's traumatized kids like Darla Knipe's son.
Person who is supposed to be watching him was standing outside the door, not watching him. So I go and I asked her, I said, what is that noise? Oh, I don't know what that is. And that's when he started banging his head.
Governor J.B. Pritzker says he'll push for legislation to ban schools from using so-called quiet rooms.
That story and what's happened according to that story are appalling. That is unacceptable. That is something that upon reading it, my entire governor's office and our administration began to move against that.
Well, a story about some schools using isolation rooms to lock students inside caught the attention of the public and state leaders this week. And we'll be talking with the reporter who did that investigation. And those who want to take over for retiring Illinois Senate President John Cullerton are making some moves behind the scenes to lock up support. We'll discuss that and more here on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford. With me in the studios of NPR Illinois on the campus of the University of Illinois Springfield is Charlie Wheeler. He's an emeritus professor and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at UIS, and also a longtime State House reporter and observer. Joining us from the Capitol building is IPR State House editor Brian Mackey. And with us from Chicago in the studios of WBEZ, we have ProPublica Illinois reporter Jody Cohen. And Jody, thanks for being with us this week.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm going to jump right into this ProPublica investigation. It found that children were placed in locked rooms at schools. Pretty heartbreaking story to get through, and pretty stellar journalism as well, Jody. So congratulations on that. Talk to us about how this idea for the story came about. How did you learn about it?
So every other year, schools have to report to the federal government their use of seclusion and physical restraint. And Jennifer Smith Richards at the Chicago Tribune, she's a longtime education reporter, as am I, and we were looking at the data from Illinois and saw really high numbers of the use of seclusion here. And Illinois is thought to have had a very protective law. Seclusion can only be used under certain circumstances. There had to be constant monitoring. It could only be used if a student was a danger to themselves or others. It all had to be documented. And we started asking, why is this happening so often in Illinois if there is this law that is thought to be protective? And we decided to start requesting public records from school districts, and it went from there.
So when you mentioned students being a threat to themselves or others, we're talking in some cases, this has been used with some pretty young students, not just maybe high schoolers, people might think that, but this is much younger, correct?
Yes. So when we ultimately ended up getting records from more than 100 school districts, and we then took those records, we created a database, and were able to track the times when isolated timeout, as it's called in Illinois, was being used. So we ultimately examined 20,000 incidents of seclusion from the 17-18 school year and the beginning of last school year. And we could systematically look through each incident at the age of the student, when it was available, what happened, what led to the seclusion, what happened once the child was in seclusion, sometimes the race of the student, although that was we did not have a robust data set in the end for that. And through that, we did see that this was happening to very young children, elementary school children, kindergarteners.
As somebody who, is a parent, and my son's much older now, but I'm wondering, did parents know this was going on? Were they told about this?
So Illinois law says that parents need to be notified within 24 hours of an incident of isolated timeout or restraint. But there were no specifications other than they had to be told and they had to be given the number to call. And so school districts were keeping really detailed information, incident reports, but parents often were not given those. They would get a kind of a generic letter with a, you know, check mark next to isolated timeout. Sometimes they would be sent in the mail, and, you know, in some of the more rural parts of the state, parents might get them a week later. They had no real information. Parents said they were, you know, kind of meaningless. Also, parents were not always getting them. The law says that isolated timeout is defined by a student being prevented from leaving the space. It actually says nothing about a door. Some school districts were saying if the child was not behind a door, a closed door, they didn't consider that seclusion, and parents had no idea that that was happening.
And talk just, if you could, for a moment about some of the reports. The part that I think that really stood out to most people is when you read about how these kids reacted, screaming, crying, doing physical harm possibly to themselves in there as well. This was not something where they went and they sat down and they cooled down all the time. This was traumatic for a lot of them.
Yes. It was heartbreaking to read the reports. You read children begging to be let out, you know, banging themselves against the doors, trying to pry open doors that they couldn't open, sometimes sitting in a corner crying. Because staff members were keeping moment-by-moment logs in many cases, they even included the dialogue of the students. So they would write down that a student was saying, "I'm crying alone," or "Please, please help me," or "Please let me out. I promise not to rip the piece of paper again." And we decided in the story to really feature these children's voices. These were children who were crying out alone inside these rooms. And we wanted our readers to hear the children in the same way we did when reading these reports. And the reaction we've had to that has been really powerful. I mean, people are very upset reading them. We've heard it's very hard to get through. But they, you know, we hope people will continue reading and listen to the children.
And Charlie, this is something that, I mean, heartbreaking is about the only word you can think of when you hear some of this. And I know there are kids who have problems and there are kids who act up at school for different reasons. But again, this is school we're talking about. Surprising to read some of that.
Yeah, and some of it were kids who did have problems, who were special education students. And the thing that got me and that was most appalling, and I thought to myself, how in the name of heaven can you be there, an adult, watching some little kid beating his head against the wall or wetting his pants or crying, and you're just there calmly taking notes. "Oh, little Jimmy wet his pants. Oh, he took his clothes off." I'm thinking, what kind of person are you? What kind of a sadist are you to be able to do that?
And Jody, let me ask you on that, what did you find out as far as staff? I'm sure there are many people who didn't go along with this policy.
I think it was really part of the culture and part of the norm at some schools. We've even talked to parents whose children didn't come home talking about this like it was wrong or abnormal. Like they, especially really little kids, they thought this is what happens. Now, just to be clear, I mean, some of the children have very challenging behaviors. They either, emotions get escalated very quickly. They're in therapeutic day schools. Of public therapeutic day schools, often because of their emotional and behavioral disabilities. That's why they, their traditional home districts felt like they couldn't be educated there. So the children, sometimes can be violent and hit and kick and bite. So staff members would use the seclusion room as a tool. I think what we found is that for some schools, it had become the tool
Brian, let me bring you in here, because after this story was published and the reaction to it was pretty quick, we saw swift reaction both from Governor Pritzker and then the State Board of Education.
Yeah, Governor Pritzker, as we heard at the top of the show, called it abhorrent. The State Board of Education, within a day, basically, had filed emergency rules that would ban isolated seclusion practices, they call it. So they're going to allow timeouts if a trained adult is in the room with an unlocked door, but supposedly only for therapeutic reasons or protecting the safety of students and staff, they say. I think what's striking when you look at some of the photos that accompanied the work of Jody and her colleagues, some of these rooms don't even have handles on the inside of the doors. This is something that's going to have to be rethought from top to bottom in terms of the actual physical spaces that people are using. But, I mean, really, it seems as though there is a pretty swift reaction from state government and a lot of people who are interested in changing this practice.
And Jody, does that do enough to, like you had said, there may be some reasons why students need to be separated, at least from other people or other students, you know, to not cause harm to them as well. But does this do enough? Is this a good step forward?
So I think this is the beginning. There's going to be, for sure, a lot of discussion, debate, public hearings. Once on the emergency rules, as ISB looks to write permanent rules, we've heard that there will be legislative hearings. So I think there will be a lot of activity. ISB has, the Illinois State Board, the deputy governor, filed complaints on behalf of children named in the investigation to ISB yesterday. So there are 9 complaints already filed. ISB is taking complaints from the public and is now empowered through the emergency rules to investigate those cases. So I think there's going to be a lot to monitor and a lot to watch and see what happens.
Jody, my recollection is that not all schools used this tool. Is that correct?
Right. Oh, that's for sure correct. It's not like every single school in the state of Illinois has a seclusion room.
Yeah, and so it occurred to me, what are the ones without the rooms doing differently that leads them to believe, well, we don't really need one of these rooms because we're able to handle these kids in this other way?
So we spoke to one special ed cooperative director, for example, in North DuPage in the suburbs of Chicago, who when he took over that district a couple years ago, on the very first day, he took the door off the isolated timeout room and it is now more of a sensory room. It has a lava lamp. It has beanbags. It has music if a student wants to listen to it. The student is not there by themselves. As I said, there's no door on it. So I think schools will reimagine what these spaces can be used for, train staff in more de-escalation techniques, in working with students so that a behavior does not become so escalated that there is a need to have a space where a student would need to be secluded alone. Really understanding, working with children to understand the root of the behaviors. You know, why is the child ripping up the math worksheet and kicking a desk? So working more with students to
prevent. And another thought that occurred to me, is it possible that these are school districts that don't have enough trained personnel? I don't know what they would be, social workers, psychologists, whatever, to deal with these problem, in quotes, children, and so they have to kind of do the old-fashioned, well, we'll just lock them up instead of trying to counseling them. Is there a need for additional support personnel in these situations?
So I am betting that there will be discussion about social service safety net, the decline in social services in the state, mental health help, more funding for school social workers and behavioral therapists and psychologists. So I think that will all be part of the discussion.
Well, that was one of the issues, if I recall correctly, in the Chicago teachers' strike, right?
Yes.
The teachers' union wanted more of that kind of backup.
Yes.
But if I recall correctly, the Chicago Public Schools, District 299, does not use these isolation rooms.
So they've had a policy for 11 years now that not to use seclusion in a Chicago public school. So some Chicago public school students are transferred to, you know, special education cooperatives and other schools throughout the state when CPS feels that they cannot be educated within a CPS school. That's not just CPS. I mean, that is, you know, traditional school districts across the state. I mean, that's, you know, there are 70 special education cooperatives throughout the state. So, but in answer to your question about CPS, it has been a policy for more than a decade not to use a seclusion room.
And we know we're going to hear more about this, including, as you mentioned, hearings. I believe legislation is going to be filed as well. So we'll continue to follow that. And again, a good job on that story, Jody. And we do appreciate it. If people haven't read it yet, you can find it through ProPublica Illinois' website. Jody, we know you've got to move on, but we thank you for spending some time with us here on State Week.
Thank you.
Well, another report came out this week, this one showing emails from someone who has been close to the House Speaker, Michael Madigan. This report finding money going from certain lobbyists to a former Madigan aide who was let go after allegations of sexual harassment. Brian, what to make of this?
Well, that's a great question. That is sort of the question. And it's not just what we make of it, but what are potentially federal investigators making of this. So just to give a brief overview, there were these two stories this week, both focused around a guy named Mike McLean, who was a state representative decades ago, but since then has become had been a top state house lobbyist and a close confidant of House Speaker Michael Madigan. The two Mikes, they were referred to in the story. And McLean reportedly, the Tribune and the Sun-Times separately reported on these emails he had written involving the word magic. So one of them had a magic Excel spreadsheet of campaign donors and the other one was about these magic lobbyist list. These are people who have or at least reputed to have special access to the speaker or close ties to the speaker. Although the speaker's name is not mentioned in these emails, there's references to himself, which a nice touch in the Tribune story reported. Apparently there's some Gaelic understanding of that phrase as the head of the house. Not coincidentally. So this is just more, and maybe we should even back up even further and say McLean, one of his big clients had been ComEd, which has been subpoenaed, and the name of that company, the power generation company, has come up in a lot of the federal investigations that have been popping up all over state government. And McLean's association with ComEd apparently has been at the heart of what led to a raid on his own home in the Quincy area, where federal investigators were looking for information from him. So just raising further questions about how deep and how broad this investigation into state government is going.
And Kevin Quinn, that name keeps coming up. That was the person, as we mentioned, was let go from the State Democratic Party, I believe, operation that Madigan oversees. After these sexual harassment allegations coming to light, a lot of people felt as though that Madigan made some swift moves in that moment to get rid of a person who, had these allegations brought against. Then to find out maybe that there's something else going on behind the scenes, and whether or not Madigan was part of that, we don't know for sure. But if that was the case, it seems like this opens this entire thing back up again.
Yeah, and I didn't even mention that part of the reporting that came out this week. That was that, and I believe that was also in the Tribune, that Kevin Quinn, and some of this had been reported earlier this year as well by the Tribune, but that McLean had coordinated a number of lobbyists who threw some work and some money toward Kevin Quinn after he had been let go from the speaker's staff. He was going through a very unpleasant divorce proceeding at the time. And McLean apparently coordinated, even coached Quinn on how to structure his contracts. He was not going to be lobbying, but he would monitor House committees and for any important legislation for these lobbyists. The real question here, though, I think when people who are that close to the speaker speak, it's sort of assumed by the recipients of that speech that they are speaking for the speaker, because the speaker, we know, does not deal directly with very many people. There are a lot of intermediaries, some number of intermediaries. Maybe a lot is not the right word. So there's this assumption that they are speaking for the speaker. But what's not known is whether the speaker endorsed this. I mean, as you said, the speaker was very loudly. He quickly fired Kevin Quinn when this came to light. He was making a lot of noise about trying to do the right things to prevent harassment in his organization. He swiftly fired his longtime chief of staff and head of the Democratic Party of Illinois, Tim Mapes. But at the same time, people around the speaker were trying to sort of extend a hand, a helping hand, to these individuals who had been cut loose by the speaker. So was the speaker directing that? We don't know. And it would be speculation to say he was or wasn't at this point. That is the question.
And let me just again read from the Tribune article where a Madigan spokeswoman quoted there saying, if a group of people were attempting to help Kevin Quinn, the speaker was not a part of it. So we will continue to follow this in the coming weeks, but we know we probably have not heard the last of the investigation and that reporting that's going on around all of this as well. But let me move over to the state Senate, because when we sat down to do this show last week, we had just about a day earlier, not even quite that, gotten word that John Cullerton, the longtime Senate president, would be stepping down come January. And of course, that set off a lot of rumors about who will be his replacement. That, again, will not happen until January, but we're seeing a lot of maneuvering behind the scenes. And Brian, what do we know at this point is who are maybe the front runners to take over that position?
Yeah, well, I had joked last week that there were, if there's 40 Democratic senators, probably somebody told me that probably 38 or 39 of them thought they were in a good position to succeed Cullerton. This week, what we're really hearing is that there are at least two sort of front runners. State Senator Kimberly Lightford, who's a Democrat from Maywood, says through reporting, there's been reporting that she has, I think she has 14 votes locked up, although then there were some subsequent reports that says she's maybe overcounting there. And then State Senator Don Harmon, who's a Democrat from Oak Park, is also attempting to round up votes for himself.
And we had heard, I believe, Charlie, last week that, you know, people like Senator Tony Munoz been around a long time there, that we'd heard Andy Menard's name, others. But according to at least some of the reports that are out, that maybe they have pulled their or put their support behind Lightford at this point. You mentioned Lightford. Don Harmon as well, Kim Lightford.
Yeah, and Andy Menard has, in fact, mm-hmm. and he is joined with Heather Staines, who would be another potential candidate, and they're kind of setting up a fundraising operation for Lightford's run, I guess, and were she to be elected Senate president, so that there would be campaign funds for her to use to help support Democratic candidates for the Senate.
Well, talk about that, Charlie. Is that typical that we would see fundraising already at this point? Have we seen that in the past?
Yeah, in this day and age, fundraising goes on 24/7, 365 days a year, 366 in leap year. It's an ongoing process, so that's not particularly surprising.
Okay. And Brian,
and just, I think that's an important, I should say, just to add to what Charlie had said, that is an important thing that the Senate president does. I mean, those of us who focus on government and policy think of the Senate president in terms of the legislative function, but it's a huge political job, and arguably the main responsibility of a Senate president is to make sure her or his members are reelected and try to grow their majority wherever possible and prevent it from being shrunken by challengers from the other party. So fundraising, I think, is something that is important to other senators. They want to know that they have somebody who can help them fend off ads from the opposition when it comes time to campaign.
And that's a good point, Brandon. And Charlie, when it comes to, you've got the money aspect of this, you also have, though, these relationships. These people have been in the legislature for about 20 years, both Harmon and Kim Lightford. And so they have worked with certain people maybe better than others. So there's some friendships, relationships there that also could come into play when it comes to who's going to support who.
Yeah, and that's what all the talking is about that's going on now. Because if I'm just a rank-and-file senator and I work closely with Senator Harman on certain issues, Senator Lightfoot on other issues, I'm kind of torn about who should I support. And I'd be talking to other people like myself trying to figure out who would be best positioned to move us as a caucus forward. And I know some of the younger senators, it's been reported, particularly want someone who will maybe stand up to Speaker Madigan more forcefully than they perceive John Cullerton doing.
And that's always something that is a little bit of a drama behind the scenes at the State House is the House and Senate rivalry.
As a matter of fact, for much of Governor Blagojevich's term, Senate President Emil Jones was siding with Blagojevich against Michael Madigan.
And that's where you hear people say, hey, we're the upper chamber, right? The Senate is the upper chamber, yeah. Which is, I mean, you know, the Constitution doesn't really differentiate that much, but there is a certain pride, and it goes beyond the Senate, House, baseball, and basketball games every spring.
I'll make a prediction right here that whatever the ultimate battle and outcome will be for the next Senate president, it will not be anything at all like what things were 40 years ago.
And that was the drama that also was playing out.
Yeah, there was a drama in 1977 where the Senate took, I want to say, 186 ballots before they finally elected a Senate president in the middle of February. And then 4 years later, as Governor Thompson presided over the Senate at the beginning of a legislative session, the Democrats again were split. And so Thompson said, well, the Republican is the Senate president because he got the most votes. And that resulted in, for a month, we had two Senates, a Democratic Senate and a Republican Senate. One met in the afternoon, one met in the morning. And finally, the Supreme Court stepped in and said, no, you got to have 30 votes to be Senate president. And so after more than a month, we finally got a Senate president. So I think it's safe to say, whether it's Lightfoot or whether it's Harman, it will not be dragged out for more than a month as happened back in the day.
Let us hope so. Let's go on
pretty sure that Governor Pritzker would not name Bill Brady the Senate president, despite
we'll,
the convenience
we'll see
of how goes. Finishing that process.
Let's go on to our notes from the field. And, Brian, let's go to you.
There was an interesting tweet from the Illinois State Police this week. A number of media outlets, including our own Sam Dunklaw, picked up on that. It said that the state police this year so far had issued 2,492 tickets for a certain category of speeding drivers. That category, people going more than 100 miles an hour. It seems rather insane to me. I mean, personally, you know, 70, I appreciated the 70-mile-an-hour speed limit when it happened. I feel a little nervous going much, you know, too much beyond that. Apparently not everyone agrees. Some people going 100 miles an hour. State police say, please slow down. That's an insane way to get around.
Also did want to mention this week really quickly that a longtime fixture, a lobbyist at the State House, Dick Lockhart, who had been around for decades at the State House, passed away. We want to give our sympathies to his family as well. That's all the time we have for this edition of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, and Jody Cohen with ProPublica Illinois. Get a podcast of the show at nprillinois.org. Production assistance for the program provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.